This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our Sex Podcast Collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. It is Friday, May 3rd. I hope you've been enjoying all the shows that we've had for you. I have been on the road in New Mexico and in Portland, Oregon, and I am going to go back on the road in a couple weeks, but don't worry, we have plenty of shows for you. It's also my birthday month. I think as we get older, we shouldn't really adhere to this one-day rule. I'm going to consider all of May my birthday month. My actual birthday is May 9th, so we'll have a live show on May 10th with an amazing guest who I'm going to fangirl about basically for 50% of the time and then talk to like a normal person for the other 50%. That person is Esther Newton, who is a really, really, really famous professor and writer, wrote one of the most pivotal books that has been used in queer theory called Mother Camp, and has a new memoir out called My Butch Career. And like I said, there will be fangirling, which, you know, I don't do that often. So we are talking about history today. I actually, you know, was just at Kinkfest. There were like 1,650 people there. It was really a fun event. Tons of people. One of the things that struck me was the dungeon, which is huge, had a lot of diverse play. You know, it wasn't, sometimes you go to dungeons and you kind of see the same thing. And sometimes that's like het male dominance who are doing impact play or bondage. So they're flogging or they're spanking or they're tying up heterosexual female submissives. And it's sort of like one scene after the other kind of looks the same. Well, the gender diversity was much different at this event and the sexual orientations. There were suspensions, there was bondage. Yes, there was flogging, but there was also needle play, there was single tailing, there was an entire section just for pet play. So if you were a pony or a kitty or a puppy, there was a little section for you. There were several ponies in attendance. One was pulling a cart around the dungeon, which was amazing. Then there was a section for littles. So if you do age play, there was like a whole sort of childcare, for lack of a better word, section set up. People were wrestling. There were like 5-on-1 gangbangs. There were people dressed as unicorns. There was a forced orgasm scene I watched. I mean, it had a lot of variety. And so it was fascinating to come home and start the book of our guest today, who I actually got to meet in person at Kinkfest. You know, sometimes I only meet people over the Skype, but I actually got to meet him. And so to come home from a very vibrant kink event and then delve into this incredibly thorough history of SM was really fascinating. So let me tell you about him. Peter Tupper's writing has appeared in Wired, the Canadian Medical Association Journal, the Globe and Mail, the Utney Reader, and the Tyee, TYEE.ca. He is a co-founder of Metro Vancouver Kink, a nonprofit BDSM community organization in Vancouver, British Columbia, and remains active in the BDSM scene. He's researched and blogged about the history of consensual sadomasochism since 2005 and has presented at The Art of Loving, the Center for Sex Positive Culture, many years, and the 2016 Master Slave Conference. He's been a guest on Grey Dancer's Ropecast, the Massocast, Jack Ranella's Leathercast, Erotic Awakening, Sluts and Scholars, and the People of Kink podcasts. He edited and contributed to Our Lives, Our History, Consensual Master-Slave Relationships from Ancient Times to the 21st Century, which won the 2017 Jeff Maines Nonfiction Book Award from the National Leather Association International. He's the author of A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Peter.
Thank you, Tristan. Good to be here.
So there's probably a million people like doing or thinking or planning something kinky right now all over the place. What made you decide, I'm not just a kinky person, I'm not just into the kink community, but I want to go all the way back in time and find out how it all began and write this book?
Well, I remember thinking, like, I got involved in the kink life when sort of like Usenet was the cutting edge of communications technology. Mm-hmm. And I heard a lot of sort of, that would also coincide with when I was studying for my history degree. And so I was always thinking of, like, where do things come from? What is the basis of them? And whenever I sort of would look into this, I'd hear the same sort of snippets about, the Marquis de Sade or John Willie or ancient Roman flagellation or something like that. And it was like Christian flagellants. Mm-hmm. And there were all these sort of little bits and pieces that never tied into each other. They never presented a coherent story of how this grew and what these things had to do with each other. And that sort of was in the back of my mind for a long time. And around 2005 is when I started seriously thinking about writing a nonfiction book, part of my journalism work. And that's when I got it and researching it. And the material that eventually coalesced into A Lover's Pinch you have before you. So I think it's very important to have an understanding of what we do, of where that comes from. Understand, you know, the inherited, what we've inherited it from, what we, and, you know, what certain assumptions that we may have carried on without knowing it, or certain potentials that we've lost that we could recover. So, and I think that that's a very important, you know, especially if we sort of view kink as an identity, not just as, you know, something that's fun, but as like a identity and community. And history is an integral part of that. So I'm hoping that that's what my book will contribute.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I do think that some people think of BDSM as, or kink as an activity, as something they like to do in bed. But there are plenty of people who would consider kink their sexual orientation, their core identity, their community, as you said. And it's interesting to think that we've been descended from such different traditions. I think that's what struck me about your book, is that you've pieced together a lot of different things. You're not tracing it back to kind of one thing. You're tracing it back to many, many things, and also many histories kind of being formed simultaneously. And so that's, I think, part of what accounts also for the diversity that we have now, right? Is that, you know, there was once a leather subculture that really revolved around leather. Leather itself was a key component. And, you know, I attended a workshop at Kinkfest on latex fetishes, latex sucky bags, and latex beds and all that stuff. And I thought, see, now this has literally nothing to do with leather, but this person is part of this community that once began from another community that that leather was central to. So it's like we've branched out from all these different ways, and that your book really sort of hits home on that. And I too feel like I've heard, I mean, I feel like once you got to like the 70s in your book, the 1970s, I was like, okay, I know a lot of this. Before that, I was like, okay, I've heard tell of this. And of course, you know about the Marquis de Sade and the story of O and some of these famous, other famous people who've written books. But really, there was so much in here that I didn't think to sort of connect all together. So I feel like we have so much to talk about, but we have to take our first break. I don't know how that happened, but do you want to respond to that? We have 1 minute.
Yeah, I'm just saying that. I mean, the analogy I used is like discovering a network of hidden passages in a city, and you know, you open a door, you walk through a corridor, and you're in a completely different building than the one you would have thought of, and that so many of this thing sort of like little snippets of little bits of history and little bits of culture that. It's kind of almost like a bizarre coincidence that they even thought people thought they would have anything with each other at all.
Right.
Like when John Whaley was publishing Bizarre magazine, you know, he had all these pictures of these women in these sort of pseudo Victorian outfits of and corsets and stuff like that. But he also had a picture of a very young Fakir Musafar when he was called calling himself Ibito. And doing like body mind based on sort of, tribe beliefs. And it's like, that was, what did that have to do with each other? Not somebody decided that they had some connection. And so this sort of tossed salad of ideas is to me one of the things that's so fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great example because you describe it in the book. It's like Bizarre had these certain kinds of fetishes and these certain kinds of photographs. And then all of a sudden, here comes Fakir, who's doing extreme body modification, also doing sort of modern primitive things. He's known, you know, in history for doing hook pulls, which that wasn't in the magazine. But we've all somehow occupied the same space for a long time. And it's interesting to see where that all first got going. So let's take a commercial break, hear from our great sponsors. And when we come back, more with Peter Tupper. Stay with us. Tasty Hole. It's the world's first flavored butthole scrub to enhance the rimming experience. It gently exfoliates the external part of the anus and flavors it. Think glazed donut hole, peach ring, hot vanilla latte, and cherry gobbler. When I first heard about this product, it did seem like a novelty, but I think it's the perfect gateway for beginning rimmers. It encourages you to dive in and eat some ass. And anything that does that is awesome in my book. Find it at tastyholescrub.com. Use code Tristan for $10 off your order. That's tastyholescrub.com.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Do you know what the month of May represents? Why, May is Masturbation Month. You knew that. We all know that self-care is sexy, and solo sex play is part of self-care. So join the Pleasure Chest as they dive deep into all things masturbation this month. They'll be going live on Instagram all month with free online classes centering self-care and self-pleasure to get you more in touch with yourself and all the benefits masturbation can bring. On May 10th, they'll be exploring femdominance. May 17th, sex in your cycle. May 24th, expanding your orgasms through solo play. And May 31st, sex toys for the curious. All these live workshops will air at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. And during those live classes, there will be specials to take advantage of. Follow at Pleasure Chest Stores on Instagram to check out all information on these classes and more. And of course, go to pleasurechest.com to find out about in-store Pleasure Ed classes, their new products, and of course, their reliable, great customer service. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with Peter Tupper about his book, A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism. And we are ready to like dive right in. I suppose the place we should begin, Peter, is with religion. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the roots of BDSM in religious contexts.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things, most interesting parts of it, and the one that goes back the deepest. And so, like, all over the world, in many different cultures, you've got people doing physical ordeal rituals where the body is put in stress. You have the Okipa or Sundance rituals among Native peoples of North America. There's fasting, there's, and especially for our purposes, there's conditions of voluntary flagellation as an instrument of, and all of this ties into the idea of sort of ritual transformation. The idea is that, you overload the body's senses and in a controlled and careful way, and you sort of cause the body, the identity, to dissolve temporarily, so that you can, you know, the person can achieve a new status in society. It's part of the ritual process identified by anthropologists, and Christianity is not immune to this. So in early Christianity, you had many different situations of physical ordeal rituals. You had people who would wear, men and women who would wear hair shirts, who would fast, who would beat themselves. A lot of this was done sort of in imitation of Christ, or like all of this, especially the, you know, the description of Christ being flagellated as part of the passion. But the interesting thing about what happened interestingly in Christianity is that the Catholic hierarchy was never completely comfortable with this. And there was a lot of controversies back and forth over whether this should be allowed, whether lay people should be allowed to do this, whether the church should sanction it or not. And a lot of the sort of the popular heretical movements included flagellation or as part of their practices. And it got to the point where, like, there was this mass uprising that threatened the Catholic hierarchy that was so scary that basically the Pope had to issue a ban saying, no, you can't do this anymore. Lay people are forbidden from religious flagellation. Now, what interesting thing that happened here is that this, where it sort of got squeezed out of sanctioned religious practice, but around the same time, like in the Renaissance, say circa 1500, is also when you started seeing the earliest cases of secular flagellation. So there was an astrologer named Pico della Mirandola who wrote what might be called the first case study of a sexual masochist who enjoyed being beaten. As part of sex, you know, in order to have sex. And it's possible he was actually writing about himself. And this is like discussed in sort of purely physiological terms. It's not, you know, discussed as part of of religious observance about penance or imitation of Christ or anything like that. And there's this weird ambiguity between the sexual and the religious. So for example, there was St. Teresa of Avila who claimed that she had been transverberated by an unseen force, that an angel had come to her and stabbed her repeatedly in the abdomen with a spear driving her to some kind of religious ecstasy. And, you know, from our perspective, it's hard not to read that and read it as some kind, hear about that and read it as, not read it as some kind of repressed sexuality. Mm-hmm. But there was a great deal of ambiguity. Like, there's a famous sculpture of St. Teresa in, I believe, Venice, which where people were upset that the saint was portrayed in this life-size statue as being too sensual, even though, like, she's wearing like a full monk, nun's habit, and so all you can really see of her is her face and her hands and one bare foot. But it's sort of like the pose and the lines of the habit were seen as a little too sensual. And there were even stories. There's a report of like a person self-polluting themselves in front of this statue. Mm-hmm. So there was this weird ambiguity between the sexual and the sensual. And eventually the Catholic hierarchy pushed that out of official religious practice for the most part. And this is also when you started seeing, you know, the earliest accounts of flagellation in brothels as part of sex work. So this is when it sort of, it began in a religion, but Christianity sort of pushed it out, and it turned up in sexuality, in the sort of rogue form of sexuality.
Right. I mean, it was interesting, like, because there was a sense that when people were doing it in religious contexts, they were reaching a kind of like new level of consciousness or sort of transcendence. And then inevitably that could lead to ecstasy, right? A sort of ecstatic experience. And it seems like the Catholics thought they had the ecstasy thing under control. And then all of a sudden they were like, oh, wait, but we're not saying it's sexual. No. It's not sexual. So then if they're pushing it out, and of course that's the beginning of the repression, right? That's the beginning of attempting to extricate sexuality and sensuality from religion, where then it becomes taboo. So of course it's showing up, especially among sex workers, where people often go to experience things that they can't experience with their partner in everyday life, right?
Yes.
You know, you also go into slavery, which of course in America, like, we have to discuss slavery and not only because we have master-slave relationships, but also because of this physical violence against slaves. And I also found it fascinating that part of what you trace is kind of the panic around white slavery, around white women being sort of kidnapped and sold into slavery. Let's talk more about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you can see that was a big sort of moral panic in the late 1900s when you had, late 1800s, late 19th century, when you had people, there were worries about people being abducted, you know, white women or Protestant women or Christian women being abducted and carried off somewhere and having unspeakable things done to them. And you can trace that lineage all the way back to the 15th century, when there was this persistent fantasy about women being abducted from the Christian world of Europe to the Muslim world of North Africa by pirates. And this became this scenario became the seed of a lot of fantasies about women being, you know, sexually exploited in all kinds of sexuality that was considered forbidden and therefore titillatingly attractive to the European readers. And, you know, the Orient, the Muslim part of the world at that time, was seen as this place of all kinds of strange sexual practices and exotic treatments. And so this became, you know, fodder for fantasies of the Christian Europe, and sort of you had the same thing going on in the 19th century, when you had, like, there was a famous book called Memoirs of Dolly Morton. And there was about, it's a fictional book, a novel set about a white woman from the North who travels south before the Civil War to assist in the Underground Railroad. And she ends up basically being kidnapped and treated as a slave, even if she isn't technically one. So it's like this fantasy of, we set up these worlds, these fantastic xenotopias where anything is possible, all kinds of strange sexuality, strange forbidden sexualities are practiced, like homosexuality or lesbianism or sadism or masochism. And we absolutely thrill at the thoughts of, you know, women are our women, quote unquote, mm-hmm. being taken from us and sent into these, you know, strange places to be exposed and mistreated. And so it's the basis for a lot of, it's a very common trope of fantasy. And you can see the same thing with like slavery in North Africa, with American slavery. You know, we're still having it's still kind of being found a bit today in texts, but yeah, so I find that somebody once said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And I think that's a good case. That's a good example here.
Well, because you're taking this back to the 1500s when you can see how race and ethnicity are being sexualized or sex is being racialized, right? Which is something that's very much operating in Western culture and especially in America. So it's fascinating to think of that the things that they wanted to project on Muslims were not just they're a different religion than us, right? But all of these other fantasies of like hedonism, debauchery, you know, and so the other also has to be like brown people, right? It's always kind of projected in that way. And so to think that goes all the way back, and also to think of these fantasies as both fear and potentially sexual fantasies of both men and women, FYI, right? Mm-hmm. Of being, I mean, it's also a fantasy of freedom in some way, which is that now I don't have to apply the rules of the Catholic Church to my sex life. I'm in this whole other world and they're making me do it. So I can experience multiple sex partners or whatever the fantasy is of the harem or, you know, that whole construction, that whole sort of Western construction. So it's fascinating to think that back that far, we were already entangled in race and racism and, like you said, xenophobia. It's way back.
Yeah. And it's still going on. Like, it's not even necessarily against brown people. It's against, like, I think you see a similar pattern in when you get to the Nazi exploitation trope of, like, you know, the movies like Ilse, She-Wolf of the SS, or those men's magazines in the 60s. So people like a generation later were looking back at fascism and projecting all this sexual decadence onto it so it can go in many ways, and it can actually go in both directions because, like, you know, Southerners in the antebellum, they saw the North as in terms of like sexual anarchy, where the races were mixing freely and there were all kinds of, and, you know, no white woman was safe and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take another break. You bring up fascism, and so we do indeed need to go there. There's a lot about fascism in this book. So let's take a break, and when we come back, more with Peter Tupper. Hey everyone. As you know, anal pleasure holds a spot near and dear to my heart. So let's consider how we're treating our ass across the board, especially when it comes to cleaning it. If you're using dry toilet paper or wet wipes, you're doing it wrong. Switch to Tushy, the modern bidet attachment that cleans all the crap off your butt. It easily attaches to any standard toilet in under 10 minutes and provides a precise stream straight to your butthole. Using a Tushy bidet pre-anal play is nice, and of course, after sex to clean up. Go into every experience feeling fresh and confident, and then wipe it all away at the end. I love the Tushy because it's also affordable. It only starts at $69, everyone's favorite number. So do your ass a favor and wash with Tushy. Go to hellotushy.com and get 10% off your order with the promo code SEXOUTLOUD. Stop wiping and start washing with Tushy. Hi, everyone. It's Tristan. Are you passionate about sex education and want to build your career in the field, but you're not sure how to do it? Or maybe you've begun your journey as a sex educator and you're ready to get serious, streamline your business, and get paid. My Sex Educator Bootcamp training programs, level 1 and 2, are now available online, and they are great for sexuality professionals of all kinds. You'll learn how to develop your vision and mission and communicate them effectively. Discover tools for branding, marketing, networking, media coverage, building your audience, and more. The number one question people ask me is, Tristan, how did you get involved in sex education and how can I? Well, today's the day to find out. Go to sexeducatorbootcamp.com.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan at puckerup.com. That's Tristan at puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, you know, we're never going to get through all the things in this amazing book by Peter, which is a cultural history of sadomasochism. I know we're not. We just can't do it all in an hour. But there is a great section where he does trace the kind of medicalization and pathologizing of BDSM and as it makes its way into the DSM and into sort of psychology and psychotherapy, and then as it weaves its way in the DSM for all the different updates. And, you know, we are only in a place now where it has the least amount of pathologizing in the DSM. There are still a few things left in there. But watch me make an incredible segue into this commercial that I'm going to read. So I want to talk today about BetterHelp online counseling. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, anger, family conflicts, LGBT matters, grief, self-esteem, you name it, they can do it. You can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment, and anything you share is confidential. Plus, it's convenient because you can do it on your own timeline and you can go at your own pace, and you can do either video sessions or phone sessions plus chat and text. And if you first meet a counselor and you feel like that's not a good fit, you can switch at any time. This normally in the real world offline costs a buttload of money, like sort of trying out counselors, because you meet with them for an hour and then you're like, this person isn't for me. Here's $250. So I think this is a good affordable option. Plus, you guys, my Sex Out Loud listeners, are going to get 10% off your first month with the discount code LOUDSEX. Okay. So it's betterhelp.com/loudsex. You fill out a questionnaire once you get there and you get matched with a therapist. Like I said, if that doesn't work, you can get matched with another one. So go to BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/loudsex. I think I was pretty clever. Okay, so Peter, we're back.
Okay.
And I have to say that this section on World War II, Nazis, and fascism, it was like the piece of history I wanted to completely disconnect from.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to sort of be part of a cultural history of what I do now and what I'm invested in now and my community now. But you make a pretty strong case that it was really significant.
Well, yeah, I think it was. I mean, in the 70s, there was this weird spike in sexual interest in the imagery of fascism. Like, you had the Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS movies, you had the Night Porter the previous year, 74, I believe. You had the Village Voice running an article about the kink world and talking to this guy who has this, huge Nazi fetish. And I think that it's ugly, but it's something I think we have to look at. And it's very, and, people have been grappling. And I think it's something we have to look at. I remember when we were at Kinkfest, were you at when Melina Williams was doing her piece?
Yeah, I did see Melina, and Melina's been on the show before, and she often talks about very taboo topics and taboo kink play.
Yeah, and I think that we have to look at that and ask where, we end up having to draw the line, and we have to ask ourselves, where do we draw the line regarding, the problem is that the line is different for everybody. There are people who would completely lose it if they saw a person being spanked. And, I'm not holding it against that person. That's their limit, and they don't want to go beyond that. And that's, but there's also people who still regard, you and I are we're jaded perverts. So we know that would barely raise an eyebrow from us. But there's other topics that are still very difficult for some people to grapple with. Race play, mm-hmm. age play, what I've heard called collectively cultural trauma play. Mm. So you end up in areas like Nazi imagery, fascist imagery. I think that there's an ongoing process of negotiating where that line is about what is acceptable and what isn't. Where do people fit into, what's acceptable at your local play party? What's acceptable mm-hmm. in the online forum you hang out in? What's acceptable between you and your partner or partners in the privacy of your own home. So I don't know. Somebody once said that everything is edge play to somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think and I realize that a lot of people, really draw the line at fascist imagery, references to fascism or the Holocaust, mm-hmm. or to racialized slavery and things like that, and I understand that, and that's why I think that people may be able to understand. I'm thinking about the larger world. A lot of people, even if they aren't necessarily involved in kink themselves these days, I think a lot of people sort of understand that it's all consensual, that we're healthy and regular people who like doing a different thing. Mm-hmm. And they're not writing us off as a whole. And I can understand that even if they can handle that, they can't necessarily handle Nazi play or race play, because that's something that kinky people themselves often have trouble with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I feel like not there is a line for me, and Nazis are on the other side of it. And I feel like if I saw someone in a Nazi uniform, that is like a form of hate speech. Mm-hmm. It just feels like, yeah, we can actually draw the line. Like, everyone can't do like whatever the fuck they want. But I guess I feel like everyone and communities have to sort of assess what they're going to allow and what it's about. I think that's the other thing, is that it's hard to imagine eroticizing these sort of historical traumatic events or ongoing historical traumas. So I heard actually that there was someone at Kinkfest who's really into Nazi fetishist stuff. Someone sort of whispered that in my ear, as a matter of fact. And I was like, ooh, are they going to show up and do that? And they were like, no, but they've been really open about their fetish. And I don't think that's cool. And I don't know if they should be a presenter or in a position of power because of that. And so we had like a whole discussion about it. And again, it came up for me again in reading your book and seeing all these like ties to fascism and seeing all the ties to Nazism and how some of that stuff with our uniform fetishes and our interrogations and our sort of like torture fetishes. I mean, there's a direct link there.
Yeah. But I think it's more a case of, I think it's important to bear in mind that what we're doing is, like when I talked about projecting fantasies onto, you know, across these boundaries of religion or race, I think that's what we're doing here, is that we are projecting these fantasies of sexual decadence or anarchy onto fascism. Like, you know, if you look at the gold standard of example is the Ilse She-Wolf of the SS movie from 1975. And that is classic example of not just projecting onto fascists, but projecting onto a fascist woman. And, you know, there never was a, you know, that's our own projection, us, you know, democratic Westerners, we're projecting our own sexual id onto these symbols that, you know, has very little to do with the reality. I mean, it's a little off because there was a real, the Ilse character from the movie was based on a real person who was the wife of a camp commandant. But like, you know, she was disowned by the Nazis themselves. They didn't want any part of her. They thought she was like, the bizarre thing is that fascism, the eroticization of fascism has associated it with everything that real fascists hated. Mm-hmm. They hated, you know, masculine women and effeminate men. They hated decadent sexuality. They hated, perverse sexuality. They hated, all of these things that, you know, and people like, I believe, you know, and I think that, there's been at least a couple of books, probably more written specifically on this question. So I think it's important to remember that this is so much about symbols, mm-hmm. divorced from historical context. And so we're projecting these our fantasies of sexual decadence. It's very Jungian. We're projecting our shadow onto the swastika, and that is what we're eroticizing, not really. But I also feel that, you know, in some ways that, you know, with the resurgence of fascist type groups in the last couple of years in America, which I consider an extremely disturbing trend. I think so much of that is them, you know, attaching on to these symbols and not really understanding the historical context. They want their, So I don't think, like I said, if you want a straight and easy answer from me about this, you're not going to get it.
Of course,
have to document. I don't have to pan down moral judgments.
Right. It's just, it was a hard section to read, and it's hard to think that there are people who are loosely in my community who fetishize this stuff. But we're going to take another commercial break, and we're going to move on to a little lighter material when we get back. So everyone, okay, Stay with us. We're going to talk about the Hanky Code and leather in the 70s and some cool shit. So we'll be back. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Help. It's hard to ask for, but we all need it. Something that's been a part of my self-care routine for decades is therapy. But I know that therapy can be hard to access for people because of finances, transportation, time off work, or just being intimidated. BetterHelp Online Counseling offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues like depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, trauma, anger, grief, and more. Connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Get help at your own time and at your own pace. Schedule secure video and phone sessions or text your therapist worldwide and you can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's a truly affordable option and Sex Out Loud listeners get 10% off your first month with discount code LOUDSEX. If you've been wanting to talk to someone, you can get started right now. Go to betterhelp.com/loudsex. Fill out the questionnaire, get matched with a counselor. It's that simple. Go to betterhelp.com/loudsex.
Stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, I told you that Pleasure Chest was doing these great live workshops on their Instagram feed. But I also want to tell you, in case you live near Los Angeles, New York, or Chicago, that they're having in-person classes as well, and they're all free. In New York City, there's a lot going on. On the Upper East Side, May 6th, Wire People Into That live podcast event with Tina Horn, Cannabis Edition. May 7th, Upper East Side, Rope Control and Dominance with Midori. May 7th, West Village, Self Care Night. May 8th, Upper East Side, Erotic Storytelling Challenge with Midori. May 9th in the West Village, Call Me Mommy, Femme Dominance. On my birthday, people. Coincidence? I think not. May 8th, Chicago, Sex on Your Cycle, all about period sex. And May 8th in Los Angeles, Blowjobs 201. So check those out. You can find details on pleasurechest.com. We are back with Peter Tupper, and we're talking about his book, A Lover's Pinch, A Cultural History of Sadomasochism. So, Peter, as I said before, there's some sections here which I have read about and known about, gay, leather, male history. You also do a really nice job, a thorough job of tracking lesbian leather history. And one of the things that you show is that sort of alongside all of these things that were happening within queer communities, there was also a kind of straight or heterosexual, like SM culture, kind of coalescing. And that was some stuff that I didn't know about. Can we cover that?
Yeah. One of the things I've encountered is that in history, you have to work with the evidence you have. Mm-hmm. And while we've got evidence about, you know, the gay leather history going back into the 60s, 50s, even the 40s, there's not a lot about what was going on in the kink among heterosexual kinky people at that time. And it's not until, I believe it was, 71 or 72, when the Eulenspiegel Society was founded. And
by the way, the year I was born. Coincidence? Okay. I think not. Keep going.
And the Society of Janus was founded, I believe that was 74 or 75.
Mm-hmm,
there was really sort of an above ground heterosexual kink world. There are reports that there were before then, but there's just not really solid evidence. And it was apparently all very underground and you had to know a person who knew a person. There's also things like, we know even less about the lesbian kink world. Like, I found what appears to be the earliest mention of it in lesbian media, which was, I believe, was like 74.
In the Lesbian Tide. Yeah, you yes. quoted. Yes.
Yeah. And it's like, it's improbable that, you know, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Like, it's not likely that lesbians spontaneously started doing kink in 1974. Mm-hmm. But we just don't know. Like, maybe somewhere there's somebody's journal sitting in an attic that will get published someday, but we just don't know. So we have to go with what we have. And but we do have a lot of it. And the 70s is when things start happening mm-hmm. above ground and recorded. So we start to know about tests, about SOJ, about PEP. We start to hear about what eventually became the Samoa Collective, which were, you know, huge in the lesbian part of this. So these cultures, the gay culture, the lesbian culture, and the straight culture were sort of siloed off from each other into the 70s and 80s. There was a certain degree of cross-pollination, in large part because, like, gay men had the most expertise and the access to venues for events. But they were sort of, you know, operating kind of in isolation from each other and not... and a lot of that, and especially once AIDS hit in the early 80s, that's when things became very separate between the gay culture and the heterosexual culture. But this is also when we found out stuff like, I was fascinated to learn that TESS was founded by a hetero male submissive and a hetero female submissive, Pat Bond and Terry Kolb. Mm-hmm. And they basically made that because they didn't like the way the scene was functioning at that time, which was sort of very skewed towards heterosexual male dominance. And they wanted something that was sort of a more even playing field, which I think is a great thing. And that's sort of a tension that we're still dealing with today.
Interesting, right? All these years, yeah, all these decades later.
I mean, I guess it's not as bad as it used to be, I hope. At least I hope not. But it's an interesting development that, and I think it's important to show that submissives, male or female, can be leaders and contributors and to the kink world. And so, you know, don't be prejudiced against them. You know, I'm also, you know, there is a lot of crossover, like SSC, Safe, Sane, and Consensual. That was invented more or less by accident by the late David Stein. Mm-hmm. And that became sort of an overall watchword for the kink cult, you know, gay, lesbian, and straight kink world in the 80s. I think so there is and I think there's a lot we can learn from each other, straights and gays and lesbians and trans people and everybody. In our kink practice.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are more and more and more pansexual spaces today than there ever have been. And like you said, there was this kind of cross-pollination because, of course, if lesbians felt like, wait, I know all these gay guys and I'm living in the same city as them and they have clubs and I can't go in their clubs, or maybe I can get snuck into their clubs, but maybe I can learn some things from them, right? There's like, so of course, there had to be sort of straight people and lesbians in that gay leather world who were there because they couldn't find anyone else above ground, like as you said. This is just a really fascinating book. I'm so sorry we're out of time.
Oh, it's okay.
But listen, like kinky nerds and history buffs, you're going to love this book. And it's also, I think, makes a really good gift because I'm going to get it for someone I love. So I want to tell people how to find you. On the web, you can find out about this at historyofbdsm.com, on Twitter, at historyofbdsm. On Facebook, there is Peter Tupper and also History of Kink. Thank you so much for being on the show, Peter.
Ah, a great time. I've enjoyed listening to the other shows, too.
I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, A-Rod, my engineer, and everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the show. And we are doing a live version, a crossover episode of Life on the Swing Set and Sex Out Loud at the Pleasure Chest in Chicago, May 21st. So mark your calendars if you want to hear the show live and in person and talk to me and ask questions and be a part of it. Then we will see you on Tuesday, the 21st, at the Pleasure Chest in Chicago. Until next week, when my guest, of course, will be Esther Newton, take care.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.